taken had we still been in Betty. We were close enough to the highway to hear the occasional car whiz by, or see the flash of some long, silver-bellied semi-truck out of the corner of our eyes, but, he assured us, out of their line of sight. This was the way he had traveled after escaping the League, how he had navigated through most of Virginia, how he hoped to get home. We were debating whether or not Chubbs had broken his toe against an exposed tree root when the wail of a truck's horn shattered the silence. The booms that came next were infinitely worse, the thundering of something heavy falling and the resounding crack of metal snapping. We all jumped. I dropped Zoo's hand to cover my ears. The way the tires squealed just before the crash came was like the warning signal for white noise. Liam reached over and gently pried my hands from my ears. Come with me for a second. He turned back to the others. You guys, watch the bags. Before the sound had even settled in the air, we heard the screams. Not the desperate kind, the one you'd hear when someone was terrified or hurt or even out of their head with grief. This was a war cry, a rising rebel yell. After that, there was no chance of Zoo or Chubbs coming with us. They stayed behind to watch the bags as Liam and I made our way to the line of trees that separated us from the rain-soaked asphalt of the highway. The semi-truck was on its side in the middle of the road, as if it had been flung there like a toy. The smell of burned rubber and smoke curled my stomach as we crouched down, and I was concerned the trail of sparks in front of us would turn into a wall of flame. Liam stood up and was nearly at the shoulder of the road before my hand managed to catch his elbow. What are you doing? I had to shout over the sound of the rain pinging against the silver, rippled body of the trailer the truck had been hauling. The driver needed help. Yes, I knew that, and maybe it made me soulless and horrible, but I wasn't about to let Liam be the one to do it. Trucks didn't just flip over on their side for no reason. Either there was another car and driver we couldn't see, or the yelling and the accident were connected. Liam and I were still standing out in the open when the figures in black came pouring out of the trees opposite us. Every inch of them was covered in black, from the ski masks pulled down over their faces to their black shoes. There was an entire highway between us, and still the sight of them was enough to make me reach out and grab Liam's arm, squeezing it until I was sure he'd be left with a permanent imprint of my fingers. There were at least 2 dozen figures in black. They moved in unison with practiced ease. And it was so weird, but watching them flood the road and divide into 2 groups, one that went to the front of the truck, the other to the back where its boxed contents were spilling out, reminded me of a football team running a play. The 4 of them sent to the front cab climbed up and ripped the door open. The driver, who was screaming something in a language I didn't understand, was hauled down to the ground. One of the figures in black, a big one, with shoulders the size of Kansas, pulled a knife from his belt and, signaling for the others to hold the driver down, pressed its silver blade against the man's palm. I heard a scream and didn't realize it had belonged to me until that same black monster's head swiveled toward us. Liam jumped at the 10 gun barrels that swung our way. The first bullet was close enough to nick his ear as it whistled by. There wasn't even time to turn and run. The firing stopped long enough for 3 of the figures to rush forward screaming, "On your knees!" and "Head to the ground!" I wanted to run. Liam must have sensed this, because he latched onto my shoulder and forced me down, pressing the side of my face against the cold, rough asphalt. The rain picked up, filling my ear, my nose, my mouth, as I tried to bite back another scream. "We're not armed!" I heard Liam shout. "Easy! Easy! Save it, asshole!" someone hissed. I was intimately familiar with what it felt like to have a barrel of a gun dig into my skin. Whoever was doing it this time had no qualms about dropping a knee onto my back, along with their entire weight. The gun's metal mouth was cold against my cheek, and I felt someone weave a hand in my hair and give a sharp twist. That's when I disconnected from the pain and lifted a hand, trying to twist my body enough to grab whoever was holding me. I was not powerless. We were not going to die here. "Not those," I heard Liam say. He was begging. "Please." "Aw, don't want your precious papers to get wet," The same voice as before. How about you try being worried about yourself or your girl here, huh? Huh? He sounded like a jock amped up on too much juice and game adrenaline. Someone stomped their foot down on the same hand I was trying to maneuver toward my attacker's skin. I let out a choked cry, wishing I could turn my head to see what was causing Liam to do the same. Dr. Charles Merriweather, the voice read out, 2775 Arlington Court, Alexandria, Virginia. George Fields. The letters. Stop it, Liam said. We didn't do anything. We didn't see anything. Just... Charles Merriweather? Another voice said. Also male, this one with a heavier southern accent. I almost didn't hear him over the rain. George Fields. Like Jack Fields? Yes? Liam made the connection a full second before I did. This was a tribe. These were kids. Yes, we're Psi. Please, we're Psi like you. Lee? Liam Stewart? There was a shuffle of feet running toward us. Mike, that you? That from Liam. Oh my God! Stop! Stop! The gun lifted off my face, but I was still pinned to the ground. I know him. That's Liam Stewart. Stop. Hayes, get off of him. He saw. You know the rules. Jesus, are you deaf? Mike yelled. The rules apply to adults. They're kids, you asshole. I don't know if Liam finally managed to throw him off or if Mike's words did the trick, but I felt Liam rise next to me and open my eyes in time to see Liam drive his shoulder into the black figure on top of me. I gulped in a full chest of air. Are you all right? He asked. He put his hands on either side of my face. Ruby, look at me. You okay? My hands came up to grab his. I nodded. Of the six guys gathered around us, only two pulled their knit ski caps up off their faces. The big kid. Big in a Hercules kind of way, with ruddy skin and black paint under both eyes, and another one with olive coloring, shaggy brown hair pulled back into a short ponytail. The latter was Mike. He reached over and pulled the letters out of Hercules' hand and pressed them against his own chest. Lee, man! I'm so sorry. I never thought... Mike choked up. Liam let go of one of my hands to clap him on the back. What the hell are you doing here? Liam took the letters back from him and reached back to draw me forward again. We're okay now, he told me. It seemed to be true enough. The other kids in black had lost interest in us the minute Mike stepped up. God, Lee, he said, wiping the rain off his face. Oh my God, I can't believe you actually made it out. Liam's voice was tight. I thought you were with Josh when... I was, but I got through the fields, he added, thanks to you. Another kid, this one with skin as dark as Chubb's, jerked his thumb in Liam's direction. This is Lee Stewart, he demanded, from Caledonia. From North Carolina, Liam said with surprising venom. Mike gripped Liam's hand, his entire body shaking. The others. Did you see if any of the others made it out? Liam hesitated. I knew what he was thinking, and I wondered if he would tell Mike the truth about how many kids actually escaped that night. Instead, their watches went off at once, a shrill beep. That's time, Hercules said to the others. Grab the supplies and head back. The uniforms will be here any second. A single gunshot punctuated his order like an exclamation point, thundering across the open road. Liam and I both jumped back, away from them. The kids at the back of the truck were tossing down the entirety of the truck's load, boxes and crates of brightly colored fruit. My lips parted at the sight of green bananas, just a few days shy of being ripe. When they moved off and started back toward the trees, I had a clear view of the truck driver being rolled, unconscious and bound, into the ditch alongside the road. So you're what? Liam rubbed the back of his neck. Raiding anyone stupid enough to drive by? It's a supply hit, Mike said. We're just trying to bring in a little food to eat, and this is the only way that works for us. We just have to do it fast, in and out, before anyone notices us and can follow us back home. Back home? Yeah. Where are you guys headed? Mike had to shout over the people shouting for him. You should come with us. We already have our own tribe. Thanks, Liam said. Mike's dark brows furrowed. We're not a tribe. Not like that, at least. We're with the Slip Kid. You heard him? 21. East River was, after all that speculating, nothing more than a camping ground. A big one, of course, but nothing I hadn't seen before a dozen times over with my parents. After the build-up that Mike and the others had given it, you would have thought we were walking toward Heaven's Pearly Gates, not some old camping spot that had been called Chesapeake Trails in its past life. Since Mike had been the one to convince the others to take us along, he was the one stuck babysitting us as we hiked up the muddy, unpaved road, saddled with boxes of fruit that were as heavy as they were tempting. We go on these things, we call them hits, to gather up supplies for the camp. Stuff like food, medicine, you name it. We also raid stores from time to time. Liam had given me his jacket to wear to ward off the rain. Though it had turned to a faint drizzle as we walked, the damage had already been done to the flimsy cardboard boxes in our arms. Every now and then, the bottom of a carton would give out completely, and whatever kid was carrying it would be forced to stuff the sodden piles of fruit into their pockets or carry them cupped in their shirts. Kids were doubling back to pick up the scattered, bright trail we were leaving behind us. Every once in a while, I would catch myself from being distracted by the bright trail we were leaving behind. When Mike had his back turned to us, Liam snuck a hand in the top box and held an orange out in front of my face, a shy smile on his lips. When he dropped it in my jacket's pocket, he leaned over, his sweatshirt hood slipping off his head, and pressed a light kiss against my bruised cheek. After that, the cold trickle on my skin seemed to evaporate. Ow! 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 Chubbs chanted behind us. Ow! 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 You know, Mike said, it gives me hope that, after everything he's been through, Chubbs is still the same Chubbs we all know and love. Aw, that's not true, Liam said. This is Chubbs 2.0. He hasn't cried once this entire walk. Give him a few minutes, Mike snorted. I'm sure he won't let us down. Hey, I said in a low, warning tone. Not funny. Chubbs was still trailing behind, the gap between us growing with each mile marker we passed. I stopped and waited for him, not wanting him to feel like he was being left behind. Need some help? I asked as he limped up to me. My box isn't too heavy. And his was, I could tell. He was saddled with grapefruit. I could see in his eyes that he desperately wanted to trade, even if it was only for a few minutes. Instead, he lifted his chin and said over the cardboard flap, I'm fine, though I appreciate your asking. Liam and Mike burst out laughing about something. Even Zoo looked back to grin at them, Liam's hat falling over her eyes. It was amazing how much better Liam looked after only a few hours. His face was animated with a kind of energy I hadn't seen, well, ever. What was he like? I asked quietly, when he was in camp. Chubbs blew out a long sigh. Well, for one thing, he was a lot more annoying with his whole, we're gonna make it, guys, we're gonna get out one day, Pollyanna shtick. That's been dying a slow death now that he's realized just how sucky everything actually is. He stopped to shift the box in his arms. I mean, what do you want me to tell you? Lee is Lee. Everyone loved him, even some of the PSFs. They picked him out of all the blues to be a runner for the control center of our camp. Yeah? And what were you like in camp? I asked, smiling. Ignored, for the most part, he said. Unless I was with Lee. As if he'd heard his name, Liam turned. Hurry up, ladies. We're going to be left behind. Mike was in the middle of explaining how he had hitchhiked from Ohio to Virginia after breaking out of Caledonia when Chubbs and I finally caught up to them. Zoo tugged the sleeve of my jacket and pointed through the trees to our left. I had been so involved in my conversation with Chubbs that I had completely missed the silky blue lake that had suddenly come into view. The clouds pulled back, revealing the sun high overhead. The water sparkled under its touch, throwing its light around the trees that lined its every side. Through them, I could see a small T-shaped wood dock at the other end, and beyond that, several wooden cabins. "So it's more of a place to hide, then," Liam was saying. "Can he help us get in touch with our folks?" Mike frowned. "I guess, but he usually asks that you stay and help with the camp for a few weeks in return. Plus, why would you want to go home now? It's much safer here." I could tell Chubbs wanted to press this issue, but Liam charged on with yet another question. "How long has the slip guy had this set up?"
2 or so years, I think," Mike answered. "Man, I can't wait until you meet him. You are going to lose your mind."
Chubbs rolled his eyes heavenward, and I got the distinct impression that he and Mike were not all that fond of each other. "And there are hundreds of kids here, just roaming around unchecked?" I asked. "How has he been able to stay here so long without the PSFs catching on?" Mike had already explained how the camp worked. All of the kids who had gathered there, some who had escaped from camps or capture, others that had been able to hide out long enough to avoid it altogether, had responsibilities.
"Oh, see, now that's the beauty of being under the slip kid's protection," Mike said. "The PSFs can't attack him because of who he is and what he could do to them. Even old Gray is terrified of him."
"I know who it is," Liam snapped his fingers. "Santa." Zoo giggled.
"You're not too far off," Mike said. "This is going to sound super sappy, so feel free to give me shit for it. But every day here feels like Christmas."
I saw what he meant right away. Once we reached the clearing that, I assumed, had once been used for campers to set up tents, we were surrounded by dozens of kids. To our right, teens were playing volleyball, with an actual net. I heard a few shrieks of laughter and stopped to let a few little girls rush by in front of me. They were the ones that caught Zoo's attention. They all looked happy, up and shiny and smiley, and clean. Not covered in cuts and bruises and mud like we were, but in decent clothes and shoes. A few kids lounging under the trees stopped whatever it was they were doing and actually helped us carry the fruit boxes toward a white building marked office/camp shop without being asked or prompted. The office/camp shop was the sturdiest of the structures we had passed so far, built in a more permanent style than the smaller log cabins with their dark green doors. "This is where we keep the food," Mike said, like it was the most exciting thing we were ever going to hear. "And where the slip kid runs the whole show. I'll bring you guys in for an introduction. Get permission for you to stay a while."
"We need permission?" Chubbs asked. "What happens if he says no?" "He's never said no before," Mike said, shifting the box onto his shoulder so he could drop an arm around Chubbs' shoulder. Seeing he had my attention, he grinned ear to ear. "Now, you couldn't have been at Caledonia. I would remember a face like yours."
I think he thought he was being charming with those dark eyes and dimples. He looked over at Lee, who was fighting back a smile as he watched my reaction.
"Where did she come from, and where can I find one?"
"Pick this one up at a gas station in West Virginia. Bargain price," Lee said. "Last one on the shelf. Sorry."
Mike laughed again, giving Chubb's shoulder a squeeze before he hopped up the steps, ducking under a white sheet that had been strung up over the building's small porch. I glanced at it, then had to look again. The enormous black psi symbol painted there had stopped Zoo dead in her tracks and turned her face a sickly shade. I couldn't move, couldn't look away from it. Liam cleared his throat, his jaw working as if trying to shake the words loose. It was enough to stop Zoo and me dead in our tracks, at least. Alarm lit up her face like a candle. Liam gave his friend a confused look.
"What?" Mike asked, seeing our reactions. "Any reason in particular you've decorated this fine establishment with our mortal enemy's symbol?"
Liam said. It was the first time I had seen Mike's expression drop the entire time we'd been with him, which was close to 2 hours.
Something hardened in his eyes. Something strained the muscles in his jaw.
That's our symbol, isn't it?
It's Psi. It should represent us, not them.
How do you explain the black, then?
Liam pressed. The armbands, the shirts.
He was right. Everyone, in some form or another, had the color on them. Most were apparently satisfied with tying a black band around their arm, but others, and not just the ones that had hit the truck for supplies, were in head-to-toe black.
Black is the absence of all colors, Mike said. We don't segregate by color here. We all respect one another and our abilities, and we all help one another understand them. I thought if anyone would be on board with that, it'd be you, Lee.
Oh, no. No, I am on board. I am, like, captain of that ship, Liam said. I was just confused, that's all. Black is the color. Got it.
The screen door creaked open again. Mike caught it with his foot.
Coming?
Inside, I was surprised to feel a wave of heat hit my face and see the overhead lights on. Electricity. I remembered Greg mentioning something about the yellows rigging the system to work, but did they have running water, too? The front rooms were filled with piles of blankets and bedding, a few stacked mattresses, and a number of unidentifiable gray plastic tubs. The back room, the shop and the office-slash-camp-shop combo, was to the right of a small, white-tiled kitchen. Mike waved to the kids inside, who were turning whatever delicious creation was inside of their pots with long wooden spoons. The old store's wood shelves were painted a dour green, but stuffed with a rainbow assortment of canned food and bags of chips, pasta, and even marshmallows. Liam let out a low whistle at the sight of the boxes of cereal stacked high over our heads. I thought Chubbs might cry. We left the fruit on the floor in a shady corner of the room, near a girl with cropped blonde hair and a midriff-bearing black shirt. She was still clapping her hands in delight, bouncing on her toes. She couldn't have been more than 14 or 15, and seemed to have as many piercings in the cartilage of each ear.
"I knew you'd be happy, Lizzie," Mike said, tossing her a grapefruit.
"We haven't had fruit in ages," she said, her pitch rising with every word. "I hope this all keeps for a few weeks."
Mike led us out of the room, leaving Lizzie to coo over the pineapples and oranges.
"Let's go upstairs. He should be done meeting with the security team by now. Hayes handles hits, but Olivia, you'll meet her, coordinates watch duty around the perimeter of the camp. If you want, I can talk to her about getting you assigned there."
He looked down at Zoo.
"But unfortunately for you, my dear, everyone under 13 has to sit through lessons."
That caught Chubb's attention.
"What kinds of lessons?"
"School stuff, I guess. Math, a little science, some reading. Depends on whatever books we were able to scrounge. It's important to the boss that everyone gets the basics down."
Mike stopped at the top of the stairs and looked over his shoulder.
"I know you never liked using them, but there are lessons on how to use your abilities, too."
Chubbs cleared his throat behind me.
"I'm fine with what Jack taught me."
"Jack."
Mike's voice trailed off.
"Man, I miss that kid."
On our walk over, he had explained that there were 5 kids from Caledonia living in the Slip Kids camp. Mike was the only one from Liam's old room, but there were 2 blue girls, 1 yellow boy, and a green who had somehow made it all the way to Eastern Virginia. The second story of the building was more of an attic. The entire floor was 1 open room, but it was a nice one. Mike knocked on the door, waiting for the "come in," before daring to twist the handle. I heard Chubbs let out a nervous squeak, and I was surprised to feel my own heart skip a beat. The door opened to the middle of the room. To the right was a white curtain, drawn all the way over to hide what I thought was probably the living area. The window behind the curtain let in enough afternoon light to hint at the shape of a bed and dresser. The other half of the room was set up like an office. There were 2 bookshelves filled with binders and books of every shape and size. An old metal desk with peeling black paint sat in between. There were 2 simple chairs in front of the desk, and a long table pushed to the far left wall, with all sorts of electronic equipment. A TV was on, set to one of the news channels.
President Gray's face filled the screen, flanked by two American flags. His mouth moved, but the TV had been muted. The only sound, aside from Chubb's sharp intake of breath, was Clancy Gray's fingers striking the keys of the sleek, silver laptop. I would have recognized him even if he had shaved his head of thick, wavy black hair, if he had tattooed his cheeks or pierced his long, straight nose. I had spent 6 years staring up at every single one of his portraits at Thurmond, memorizing every mole, the shape of his thin lips. I was even intimately familiar with the peak of his hairline. But it was nothing like seeing the real thing. Those portraits hadn't captured his dark eyes, and they certainly hadn't been able to predict how striking he'd turn out to be as he aged.
"Just a sec."
He glanced up from his screen in our direction and immediately did a double take.
"Boss," Mike said, "you okay?"
The president's son rose slowly, shutting the lid of his laptop. The rolled-up sleeves of his white shirt slid down his tan arms. "This is the slip kid?" I thought. "Him." Surprise was an understatement. Brain-numbing shock, the kind that reduced my train of thought to an inching crawl, was an understatement. I didn't even have a second to collect myself before the next 3 words passed his lips. There was no way I could have, because Clancy Gray looked straight at me and said the very last thing on earth I expected. "Ruby Elizabeth Daly." My reaction was way too strong for something as innocent as my full name. It wasn't like he had spat out 3 vile cuss words or screamed, "Kill them now," or "Lock them up." I shouldn't have stumbled back, tripping over my own boots, but I was nearly to the door before I even realized it. Clancy took a step forward, but Liam pushed him back hard.
"Lee!"
Mike sounded scandalized. Clancy held up his hands.
"Sorry. I'm sorry. My bad. I should have realized how that would sound. I was just surprised to see you."
He leaned around Liam with an apologetic smile, and I paused at the door, momentarily stunned by how white and straight his teeth were.
"I've read your file so many times on so many different networks that I feel like we've already met. There are so many people out there looking for you right now."
"And which one do you plan on turning her over to?" Chubb snapped.
I stood still, letting Zoo keep one arm wrapped around my waist. Clancy's face flushed at the accusation, his dark eyes flicking back over me.
"None of them. I just collect information, watch the networks to see what everyone is buzzing about. And that just happens to be you, Miss Daly."
He paused, rubbing a hand absently over his shoulder. "Let's see if I remember all of this. Born in Charlottesville, Virginia, but raised in Salem by her mother, Susan, a teacher, and her father, Jacob, a police officer. Attended Salem Elementary School until your 10th birthday, when your father called into his station to report an unknown child in his house."
"Stop," I muttered.
Liam looked over his shoulder, trying to divide his attention between me and the boy reciting the sordid tale of my life.
"But, bad luck, the PSFs beat the police to your house. Good luck, someone dropped the ball, or they had other kiddies to pick up, because they didn't wait around long enough to question your parents, and, thus, didn't pre-sort you. And then you came to Thurmond, and you managed to avoid their detecting you were orange."
"Stop!" I didn't want to hear this. I didn't want anyone to hear it.
"What's the matter with you?" Liam shouted. "Can't you see you're upsetting her?"
Clancy, maybe anticipating another hard shove, moved to the other side of his desk.
"I'm excited to meet her, that's all. It's not often that you find another orange."
A spark lit at the center of my chest, spreading quickly up to my brain. He is an orange. The rumors were right. He might actually be able to help me.
"But weren't you reformed?" I asked slowly. "Isn't that why they let you out?"
"You, of all people, should know they can't reform shit at Thurmond, Ruby," he said. "How is good old Thurmond, by the way? I had the dubious honor of being its first inmate.
Got to see them build the mess hall brick by brick. Did they really hang my picture up everywhere?
A better question. Did he really think I was going to pull up a chair and shoot the breeze about the good old days?
Clancy sighed. Anyway, if you're Ruby, then you must be Lee Stewart. I've read your file, too.
Anything good in there? Mike asked with a nervous laugh.
The PSFs have been following your every move, Clancy said, leaning back in his chair, which means you need some place to lie low for a while, right?
Liam hesitated a split second before nodding.
You made a good choice coming here. You can stay as long as you need.
Clancy rested his hands on his chest.
Now that I've managed to upset everyone, Mike, do you want to take them to a cabin and get them set up in the rotations?
Mike nodded.
For the record, you didn't upset me, boss.
Clancy laughed, rich and slow.
Okay, good.
Thanks for all of your hard work today, by the way. Sounds like it was a good haul.
Like you wouldn't believe, Mike said, moving toward the door.
He waved us after him, but he no longer looked at us with the same warmth.
Cabin 18 is open, right?
Yeah, Ty and his guys went tribal on us, Clancy said. I don't know that anyone has gone in to clean it since they left, though, so I apologize if it's a mess.
And then he was staring at me again, one corner of his lips turning up, then the other. A warm, fizzling sensation filled my head, sending my pulse spiking. I turned away and broke eye contact, but the image still flooded my mind, spilling in until I thought I might choke. In my mind's eye, I saw Clancy and me alone in the room, him on one knee, offering a rose in my direction.
Forgive me.
His voice was loud in my ears, echoing as I stumbled down the stairs.
How had he done that? Waltzed right through every single one of my natural defenses.
And why was my brain suddenly alive and reaching out for whoever was closest, whoever was stupid enough to let me in? I lifted my face from where I had buried it against Liam's shoulder. When had I done that? When had we gotten outside? When had we walked all the way to the cabin? Liam's eyes tried to catch mine as I pulled away. My head ached, physically ached for him. It was too dangerous to stand so close to him.
Not right now, I whispered.
Liam's brows drew together, and his lips parted with something he wanted to say. After a moment, he only nodded and turned back toward the cabin, bounding up the steps. I needed to get as far away from them as I could, at least until the trilling inside of my head died down. There was no plan or map involved. I just set off down a nearby path. A few kids, all strangers, called after me in concern, but I ignored them, following the smell of mud and molding leaves until I found the lake we had passed. The trees and brush had overgrown the path down to the T-shaped wooden dock, and where there weren't plants in my way, there was a rope, along with a sign that warned, "Do not enter." I slipped under it and kept heading down, not stopping until I sat on the edge of the old sun-bleached dock and put my head between my knees, listening to the sounds of kids laughing and yelling in the distance, wondering when the feeling would return to my legs long enough for me to stand, and when the imprint of Clancy Gray's voice would fade. Alone, I thought, lying down on the old wood. Finally, alone. Dinner was served at exactly 7 that night. There was no intercom or alarm system in the camp, but there were cowbells. Apparently, that was a universal call for food, because once the first bell rang, others echoed back, spreading the noise through the cabins and trails, all the way down to where I sat studying my reflection in the dark water. It was easy enough to find the action. 200-odd kids gathered around a raging bonfire to eat wasn't exactly subtle. My feet slowed the closer I came, watching as a few of the older boys threw more logs into the fire's grasping fingers. Rings of old logs provided makeshift seats for those who already had their food and didn't want to eat alone in their cabins. The kids we had seen in the kitchen had set up a table full of what looked like slow cookers and were making runs between the office building and the fire to replenish them. Dozens of kids waited in line for their turn at the pots, their plastic bowls pressed against their chests in anticipation. I spotted Liam straight off, standing, rather than sitting, on one of the logs. He had a bowl of chili in each hand and was scanning the area. Chubbs would have walked right by him if Liam hadn't nudged him as he passed. He asked Chubbs something, but I caught only part of his response.
No thanks. I read Lord of the Flies. I know how this works. Everyone starts dancing around the fire and painting their faces and worshiping a decapitated pig head, and then someone gets hit by a boulder and plummets to their death. And, surprise, it's the fat kid in glasses.
Liam started laughing, but even I could see how uncomfortable Chubbs looked.
I think I'm going to play it safe and go read. And, hey, there's Ruby. You two can enjoy the degeneration of human decency without me.
Liam whirled around so fast his footing slipped, and he came dangerously close to dropping both bowls on the bushy-haired girl sitting beside him.
Have fun, Chubbs said as he hurried past me.
I caught his sleeve and swung him back around. What's wrong? I asked. He shrugged, a sad smile curling the ends of his lips.
I'm just not up for it tonight, I guess.
I knew the feeling. After it being just the four of us alone for so long, suddenly being around so many people, even if they were kids like us, was a little stressful. If he hadn't liked it when one new person, me, had invaded his world, I could only imagine what this was doing to his nerves. Well, if you change your mind, we'll be here. Chubbs patted my head fondly and continued up the dirt trail back to our assigned cabin.
What's gotten into him?
Liam asked, offering me the steaming bowl of food.
I think he's just tired, I said, and left it at that.
Where's Zoo? He nodded to the left, where, sure enough, Zoo's smiling face appeared at the center of a small group of boys and girls her age. When she saw me, she waved. I wondered how it was possible for her face to be so vibrant. The Asian girl sitting next to her nodded as Zoo gestured to her, as if knowing her every thought without her having to whisper a word. When Zoo reached over to knock back the hood of the girl's Virginia is for Lovers sweatshirt, she revealed a long, glossy black braid.
Oh my God, I said, making the connection instantly. What's wrong?
That kid was in your camp, I said. I saw her in Zoo's nightmare. They got separated?
Really?
The dawning realization that spread across his face was adorable.
Guess that explains why they tackled one another to the ground earlier.
I laughed.
They did?
Yeah, they were rolling around like puppies in the grass.
Hey, Zoo!
She looked our way again. Come here a sec.
No, bring your friend.
When the two girls were on their feet, I was surprised to see the other girl stood a good 4 inches above Zoo's head, though she looked like she couldn't have been more than a year older than her. Zoo took the girl's hand and flounced over to us, grinning. She was back to wearing the hot pink dress.
Hi there, Liam said, holding out his hand to the girl. My name is Liam, and this is...
I know who you are, the girl interrupted. Liam and Ruby.
She crossed her arms over her chest.
Suzume told me all about you.
Told you, or...
Of course she didn't tell me,
the girl huffed, earning a sharp elbow to her side. She turned and said something to Zoo in Japanese, who, in turn, shook her head and reached up to tug the girl's braid.
Okay, fine.
The tall girl turned back to us, flanked by the campfire.
I'm Hina. Suzume is my cousin.
Oh, wow,
I said, looking to Zoo. Are you serious? That's amazing. She was bouncing on her toes, still smiling.
And you were at Caledonia together, Liam said slowly.
Zoo, why didn't you mention it?
We could have tried to track her down.
Are you a yellow, too?
I'm a green, Hina said, pointing to her full head of hair.
Duh.
Zoo gave us an apologetic shrug before tugging Hina away, back to the circle of younger kids who were engrossed in some kind of card game. Liam turned toward me with a look of pure amazement.
Did I just get sassed by a 12-year-old?
I guess it runs in the family, I said, spinning my spoon around my bowl. The chili was warm, with a wonderful kick. I don't think I'd eaten anything other than the slop they'd served at Thurman and junk food in almost 7 years. And the fact that someone had put even the barest amount of effort into it?
I had to go back and get seconds, thirds,
until I physically could not stuff myself anymore. Being so close to the fire with a belly full of delicious food was making me feel drowsy and safe. I slid down off the log so I was sitting on the ground, reclining against Liam's legs. "That reminds me," Liam said. "Would you believe Zoo actually started jumping up and down and clapping when I told her she had to get up at 7 to go do some good old-fashioned book learning with the other cubbies?"
"Cubbies?"
"Daily lessons. School." He tapped my nose with the clean end of his spoon. "Stick around, Ruby Tuesday, and you'll start picking up the cool kid lingo, too." When we finished eating, Liam set both of our bowls in one of the many plastic tubs floating by. The blue, controlling the one closest to us, was a skinny kid who looked like he weighed about half of what his tub did. I blinked once, twice, wondering if I was imagining it. It was the first time I had ever seen kids use their abilities so frivolously. It was a strange contrast to what was otherwise a picture of normalcy. At least, what I assumed normalcy looked like. A few kids strummed on guitars or used their log as a drum set. Most were talking quietly or playing card games. Liam slid down behind me, finding just enough room between my back and the old log. The shimmering air around the flames, combined with a delicious heat, made my muscles turn to mush. His hand came up to brush the stray strands of hair off the back of my neck. I leaned back until I was resting against his chest, nestled between his knees.
"You okay now, darling?"
he whispered in my ear. I nodded, my fingers finding the bare skin of his forearms, tracing the muscles and overlying veins there. On a discovery mission, searching for something I hadn't even realized I wanted until now. His skin was so soft, his hands warm and wide, knuckles bruised and torn with brittle scabs. I pressed my own hand on top of his, weaving our fingers together. "I had to be alone for a little while, but I'm okay now."
"All right," he whispered,
"but next time, don't go where I can't find you." I didn't doze off so much as relax. It seemed like the longer I sat there, the quieter my head became, the more the aches and knots in my body worked themselves out, leaving me as soft as the dirt under us. Eventually, someone brought out a decades-old boombox, and even the kids with guitars stopped playing in deference to the Beach Boys. I seemed to be the only one in the entire camp who didn't dance, but it was fun to watch the others. Zoo, in particular, as she twisted her hips and threw her arms in the air, at least until she ran up to us and began to tug on our arms. I managed to beg off, but Liam didn't have nearly as much willpower. They were both laughing when the track switched to Barbara Ann, twirling when Fun, Fun, Fun came on. I should have known something was up when they both turned to me wearing identical devious looks. Liam held up a finger in my direction, beckoning me over to him. I laughed and shook my hands in front of me. "No!" He grinned, his first real grin in days, and I felt something tug at my belly button. The sensation was warm, tingling, and familiar. Liam pretended he was hauling a line in, and Zoo actually stopped her frolicking to act it out with him. Their faces were flushed and glowing with a sheen of sweat. With nothing but fine dust and mud between us, I slid right over to them, right into Liam's outstretched hands. "No fair," I whined. "Come on, Green," he said. "You could use a good dance." Zoo spun us around, waving her arms in time to "Wouldn't It Be Nice." I put my hand over Liam's, letting him drop it over one of his shoulders. He took my other hand without asking and held it lightly in his own. "Step up on my feet." I gave him what I hoped was an incredulous look. "Trust me," he said. "Come on, before our song is over." Against all my better judgment, I put my feet over his, waiting for him to wince at my weight. At least his bones felt sturdy under mine. "A little closer, Green. I won't bite." I leaned forward, close enough that my cheek was resting against his shoulder. Liam's hand tightened around mine, and I found my other hand bunching the fabric of his shirt. And I was embarrassed, because I was positive he could feel my heart hammering in my chest. "No spinning," I said. I wasn't sure if my head or heart could take it. Up close, he was so warm,
and so beautiful. I was already dizzy enough.
No spinning, he agreed.
When we began to move, it wasn't really dancing, just some glorified swaying. Back and forth, nice and easy. For once, my brain was perfectly content to keep its hands to itself. My muscles moved slow, like honey. We were completely out of sync with the song, and then we weren't even moving at all. My cheek rested on his shoulder. The hand on the small of my back slipped under my shirt and curled against the skin there. When the bells rang again, this time signaling lights out across the camp, there was an audible groan, loud enough to get Liam chuckling. I didn't realize how tired I was until we separated.
Bedtime, he called, waving Zoo over.
She stood, brushing herself off, signaling something to the group of kids she was leaving. The fire popped and hissed, buckling under a steady stream of water from a nearby hose. The sound it made was like an animal having the life squeezed out of it. And when the light was finally gone, settling down into a pile of unimpressive embers spread out among the ash, there was nothing but a screen of smoke to separate me from where Clancy Gray sat on the other side of the pit, watching me with dark eyes. 22. That was something Clancy Gray liked to do, apparently. Watch me. Watch me while I sat out on the porch helping Zoo lace her new tennis shoes before walking with her and Hina to the cabin serving as the classroom. Watch me tease Chubbs for being the first and only one to get bitten by a tick. Watch me wait by the fire pit with Lee for Mike to arrive with what our duties would be during our time at East River. All this watching from the window on the second story of the office, where he appeared to control everything and do nothing. Mike had mentioned that everyone older than 13 would be responsible for doing some work. I just hadn't realized that the assignments were chosen for you. I didn't mind helping out in the pantry, organizing and counting our supplies, but I would have so preferred being out with Chubbs in the camp's small garden, or running around the forest with Liam on security detail. It was strange not to spend my entire day with them. The kids I worked with were nice enough. More than nice, actually. Most had never seen the inside of a camp, but then again, I had never cooked a meal, so it wasn't like any of us were winning in the life experience department. What I liked most was their brand of pluck. Lizzie, for instance, had been hiding out at East River for close to 2 years, having narrowly escaped capture by PSFs who had pulled her parents' car over in Maryland. "You just got out and ran?" I asked.
"Like the wind," she confirmed. "Didn't have anything on me at all, except what I was wearing. I tried to meet up with my parents again, but they never went back to our old house. I got picked up by a tribe of Greens and brought here."
That was another thing. Most of the kids here were either green or blue, with a small, tight-knit group of yellows that didn't really socialize outside of their own circle. Lizzie claimed that there used to be more, but the slip kid had given them permission to head out and form a tribe of their own.
"He gave them permission?" I repeated, marking down how many boxes of cereal we had left.
"Yeah, and there are other requirements, too."
That from Dylan, a small-boned kid who had only recently finished his Cubby's lessons. He claimed the nickname came from the wood shelving units Clancy had built to store all of their books and schoolwork.
"You have to have at least a group of 5, he continued. "And then Clancy has to determine whether or not it's safe, and you have to swear on your life not to reveal anything about the camp, unless it's to another kid in need, and then you can only reveal the clue. It's to keep everyone safe. It would kill him if something happened to a kid because of him."
I felt myself soften a little then. It wasn't so much that I didn't trust Clancy's motivations. He just unnerved me. When someone takes such an interest in you, you have to wonder what it is exactly they're searching for in your face.
"What are you doing?"
All three of us looked over to the door, where Clancy stood stiff and still staring at me. The wind from the open door behind him tugged at his dark hair, causing it to stand on end. Something inside of me coiled at his expression, but it wasn't fear.
"We're sorting?" Lizzie said, confused. "Is something wrong?"
Clancy snapped out of whatever daze he had been stuck in.
"Yeah, sorry. It's just..."
Ruby, would you mind coming with me for a second? I think there was some confusion on your assignment.
I passed my clipboard back to Lizzie, wondering why her eyes narrowed at me.
I was assigned to storage, I said when we were standing outside on the porch.
I didn't assign you anything, he said. I specifically told Mike that.
I'd like to think that I wasn't the type of person to be easily intimidated by other kids, even the ones that were taller, stronger, or better armed than I was. So I'm not sure why it hit me then that I was talking to Clancy Gray, the son of the most powerful man in the country, a blue-blooded American prince who wore his black polo shirt with a collar popped under a matching cable-knit sweater. He was even wearing a leather belt. I crossed my arms over my chest. I'm more than capable of pulling my weight. Out in the sunlight, he was far less intimidating than he had been in the shade, and shorter. It was possible his reputation had added a few imaginary inches, but he was only a bit taller than I was, which meant both Liam and Chubb stood nearly a full head over him. Not that it did anything to knock his title of the most attractive person I had ever seen. Clancy was lean, but not slight, well-kept, but not groomed, composed, but not comfortable. I thought, as the wind blew against us, that he might have been wearing some spicy cologne, but that seemed ridiculous. I was glad we were out on the porch where everyone by the fire pit could see us. I didn't think he was going to hurt me or anything like that. Why would he? I felt my hands clasp together in front of me, then move to my side, then rise up to cup my elbows, like they couldn't figure out what they wanted to be doing. I hadn't forgotten my whole purpose in coming here, but I couldn't bring myself to ask for his help. He clearly had a good grasp on his own abilities if he was voluntarily diving into people's minds. The question should have come as naturally as breathing. If he had these kids following his every whim and order, it had to be because he was a good guy, right? People didn't help other people just for their health. Clancy had the kind of confidence that made him the sun at the center of East River's galaxy. Everything and everyone orbited around his light. So, why couldn't I bring myself to ask? Why were my hands still shaking?
I know you probably won't ever come around to liking me after our introduction, he said, but I am sorry. It didn't occur to me that you were keeping that information secret.
It's fine, I said, but what does that have to do with my work assignment? For a few moments, he didn't say anything at all. He just stared.
Will you stop? I muttered, feeling both flustered and annoyed at once. If I say you're forgiven, will you stop doing that?
His mouth turned up in a handsome grin. No. Clancy, who apparently had never been taught about respecting someone's personal space, took a step forward, and I took a step back, off the porch, my feet sinking into the sticky mud. Instead of backing off, he seemed to take it as a challenge and came toward me again. For whatever reason, mostly the flutter of nerves in my gut, I let him.
Listen, he said finally. The reason I told Mike not to assign you anything is because I'm hoping that you'll come work with me.
Excuse me?
Come on, you heard me.
His hand closed over my arm, and it was like a bee had been set loose inside of my skull. My brain seemed to lurch full speed back into life, flooding with milky white images of the two of us sitting in front of his desk, staring at each other as a fire devoured everything around us. The images he was flooding into my mind. I don't know how he did it, but it was so real. The image was burning me up from the inside out, blistering my lungs. Pockets of acrid smoke bubbled up under my skin until it felt like I was about to burst open. My vision burned to black at the edges. Fire bloomed on my clothes, singeing my hair.
This is not real. This is not real. This is not real.
Clancy must have let go, or I must have found a way to twist away, because just as quickly as the fire came, it went back out, dispersing in three shaky exhales. "You can't block me," he said, his eyes wide.
Do you even know how to use your abilities? The file the League had on you made it sound like you could control it.
Wasn't it obvious? I shook my head. That's why I'm here, I wanted to say. That's why I need you.
His gaze flicked down over me from head to toe and back up again. When he spoke, his voice was soft, sympathetic.
Look, I know how it is. You don't think I struggled with this, too? How lonely it is to not be able to touch someone the way you want to? How terrifying it is to be trapped in somebody else's head without knowing the way out? Ruby, everything I've learned, I had to teach myself, and it was awful. I want to save you from that. I can teach you things, tricks, how to use your talents the way they're meant to be used.
I hoped he couldn't see the way my hands were shaking. Oh, God, he had offered. I hadn't even had to ask. And I still couldn't say a damn thing.
Clancy's posture relaxed, and when he touched me again, flicking my braid back over my shoulder, there was no ill will behind it.
Think about it, okay? If you decide you want to, just come to the office. I'll clear my schedule for you.
I pressed my lips together, biting down hard on my tongue.
There's nothing wrong with wanting to know how to use your abilities, Clancy added. That's the only way we're ever going to beat them.
Beat who?
There are so few of us left, he said. Until you showed up in the system, I actually thought I was the only one.
Well, there's at least one more. His name is Martin.
And he's with the Children's League, he finished. I know. I accessed their report on him. Creepy kid. When I said us, I meant the non-psychotic oranges. I snorted.
I'll think about it, I said finally. I was pinned under his dark gaze again, the hair on my arm standing on end like a whisper of electricity had run over it. I took an unknowing step closer to him.
Listen to your gut, Clancy said, turning to head back inside the office. A cluster of kids called out to him from where they were setting up lunch near the fire pit, and, ever the president's son, he smiled and waved at them real pretty.
Listen to your gut. So why was it at odds with my head?
I made a beeline for the wood dock I had discovered the afternoon before, needing to find some way to wash out the jitters racing through my heart. My mind felt tangled with the possibilities. Clancy Gray had just offered me everything I could have asked for, a way to avoid repeating what had happened to my parents and Sam, a way to be with Liam, to find Grams, to not live in constant fear of what I could do to them. So why hadn't my yes come tumbling out then? I ducked under the rope tying off the path to the lake and made it all the way down the trail before I realized anything was amiss.
Crap, I said when I saw him.
Oh, no. No, 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 Chubbs said. The goofy grin dropped off his face, and he stopped throwing bread crusts out to the ducks gathered in the water. This is my secret hideout. No rubies allowed.
I found it first, I huffed, plopping down next to him.
You most certainly did not.
Try a week ago while you were unpacking?
He balked at that. Well, fine. But I got here first today.
Aren't you supposed to be on garden duty?
Got tired of hearing some girl coo about how smart the slip kid is for making them plant carrots.
He leaned back. Aren't you on storage duty?
I looked down at where my hands had clenched into fists. When I didn't answer, Chubb set the bread bag aside and sat up straight. Hey, are you all right?
He put a cool hand to my forehead.
You look like you're going to be sick. Are you experiencing any migraines or dizziness?
That was an understatement. I croaked out a laugh.
Oh. He pulled his hand away. That kind of head trouble.
I lay back against the rough wood and threw my arm over my eyes, hoping the darkness might help dampen the headache. You said Jack taught you how to use your abilities?
Pretty much, he said. That was the only way I was ever going to learn, if some other kid taught me, I mean. It just took a while to decide.
Why?
Because I thought that if I didn't use them, they'd eventually go away, Chubb said quietly, I thought everything might go back to normal. There's scientific evidence that if we stop using parts of our brains, those sections will eventually cease to function, you know? After a moment, he asked, "Did Clancy offer to help you with your abilities?" I nodded. I told him I'd think about it. "What's there to think about?" Chubb smacked me on the stomach with his book. "Didn't you say that you didn't know how to control it?"
"Well, yeah, but
I'm afraid of how much I don't know." "You need to be able to control it, otherwise it'll always control you," he said. "It'll scare you and manipulate you until you go crazy, die, or they find the cure. And guess which one of those things will probably happen first?"
The lunch bell sounded. 2 rings for second meal. Chubb stood and stretched, throwing the rest of the bread out into the water.
"You really think they're going to find a cure?" I asked.
"My dad used to say that anything was possible when you put your mind to it."
His mouth twisted into a humorless smile. At the mention of his father, my stomach clenched. "You still haven't had a chance to send them a message?"
"I've asked around, but there's only one computer in this entire godforsaken place, and only one person gets to use it."
"That's right, the silver laptop on Clancy's desk." "Did you ask him if you could use it for a few minutes?"
"Yeah,"
Chubb said as the fire pit came into view. It looked like they were handing out sandwiches and apples.
"He said no. Apparently it's a security risk if someone other than him touches it."
I shook my head. "I'll ask tomorrow. Maybe I can convince him."
"Could you?"
Chubbs grabbed my arm, his face lightening considerably.
"Will you tell him that we have a very important letter to deliver, but we need to be able to look up Jack's father's new address? Tell him we'll do anything. No, tell him that I will personally lick every single pair of shoes he owns clean."
"How about I just tell him that it's the whole reason we came here in the first place," I said, "and leave your tongue out of it." Chubbs waited until I had taken my sandwich from the table before pulling me away. I thought he might want to eat back at the cabin or even the dock, but we wandered until we found Liam. He and a few of the other guys on the security team were on a break from their rounds and had found themselves a nice clearing in the trees. It was just wide enough to square off into 2 small teams for a quick game of hoverball, otherwise known as football with no hands. Chubbs and I found an old tree trunk to share, ignoring the small group of female spectators who had gathered to cheer the teams on. A tall redhead with an explosion of freckles on his face levitated the old football at the start of a play. He ran alongside it, trying to keep both it and himself out of the reach of the others. Liam, at one point, had the football an inch in front of him, but his hands were too slow and his footwork too bad to catch it when it was tossed to him. "Keep your eye on the ball, Butterfingers," I called. Liam's head whipped around in our direction. Just as his gaze locked on mine, Mike, who had the football at that point, mowed him over to get to the makeshift end zone. Chubbs and I cringed as Liam hit the ground and knocked his head against one of the old tree's roots.
"Wow," I said. He wasn't kidding about sucking at sports. "It'd be funny if it weren't so damn sad."
The other boys were too busy laughing to keep the ball in the air. Liam stayed on the ground, his face flushed red, but his entire body shaking with laughter. He lifted his shirt to wipe the sweat off his face, giving me, along with every other girl present, a glimpse of skin. This time, I was the one blushing. One of the guys I didn't recognize jogged over to Liam and helped him up, patting him on the shoulder. They laughed together like they had known each other since preschool. But that was Liam for you. He joked about Zoo making friends at the drop of a hat, but he was the same way. But Chubbs and I were perfectly content to sit by ourselves, watching, waiting, but not dipping our toes into the ocean. Maybe we had just gotten too used to being alone, and maybe that needed to change. The next morning, at exactly 9:21, I found myself standing outside of Clancy Gray's office, my hand raised and ready to knock. The only thing preventing me, besides the nerves hula-hooping my guts, was the conversation happening on the other side of the door.
"Sure, we have the kind of numbers to do that. If I sent the amount of kids we'd need, there wouldn't be enough left here to maintain watch."
It was a girl's voice, soft but not sweet. Olivia, most likely, if they were talking about security.
I get what you're saying, Liv, but it would be a waste to miss this opportunity, Clancy was saying. We're getting low on medical supplies, and Lita Corp has stopped running as many trucks up through our area.
Are you going on another one of your trips? She pressed. Isn't that when you usually pick up tips about shipments?
Why do you ask?
It's just, you haven't gone on one in almost a year, Olivia said, and you used to go all the time. I know we haven't been hurting for supplies, but maybe if you met with your source...
No, Clancy said with finality. I can't leave the camp anymore. It's not safe.
The floorboards creaked.
Did something come up on the PSF scanner? Came Hayes' gruff voice. They heard about the fruit stunt, obviously, Clancy said. It would have been hard to miss considering you mutilated that driver.
Why do you have to say it like that?
Because you should have just left him there like I told you to. I appreciate you wanting to spread the symbol, but couldn't you have spray-painted it on the truck?
Are you worried this'll be bad for our image? Olivia's voice dripped annoyance.
Most people are going to have a hard enough time accepting that we're not monsters, without reports about us maiming innocent people, Clancy said. So please, keep spreading the black. Keep using the symbol. Just try for some subtlety.
Some what, T?
Hayes asked.
I'm sorry to cut our meeting short, but it seems like you both have things under control and I have someone waiting for me, Clancy said. I pulled myself away from the door. Liv, plan the hit. I'll worry about our numbers. I took a few steps back down the staircase, but it was pointless to pretend that I hadn't been listening. The door opened, and the girl, Olivia, was the first to appear. She was tall and willowy, with legs for days and a tan that made her skin glow. I shook my head and turned to allow her and Hayes to squeeze by. Olivia was probably about my age, but she looked so much older. She looked like what I imagined 20 would feel like. When I looked up again, Clancy was leaning against the doorframe, grinning.
You came.
He waved me inside and guided me toward his desk. Sitting down in one of the chairs, I had a fleeting look at the other side of his room, where the curtain had been restrung. Clancy took his usual seat behind his desk, rocking the chair back as he smiled.
What made you change your mind?
It's... like you said, I mumbled. There are so few of us left. And I want to know how I can be around the people I love and not be terrified of erasing myself.
I read on the League's network that they weren't able to find any other oranges aside from you and Martin, Clancy said. Most of the Reds were killed, apparently. That puts us at the head of the pack.
I guess, I said. Another thought occurred to me. How do you have access to the League's network and the PSFs? I gestured around the room. Any of this?
I have friends everywhere, Clancy said simply. His fingers drummed against the desk. And my father leaves me alone because he wouldn't be able to stand the outrage if I exposed the fact that there is no rehabilitation program. Not for people like you and me.
Me and you, I repeated. Clancy ran a hand through his hair.
The first thing you need to understand, Ruby, is that we're not like the others. Me and you, everyone classified as orange, we're different. Special.
No, wait, I see you rolling your eyes, but you have to listen, okay? Because the second thing you have to understand is that everyone, my father, the camp controllers, the scientists, the PSFs, the Children's League, they've been lying to you this entire time. We're special not because of what we are, but what they can't make us into.
You're not making any sense, I said. He stood up and came around the desk to sit next to me.
Would it help if I told you my story first?
My eyes flicked up to meet his.
If I do, you have to promise that it stays between us.
Keeping secrets, that I could do.
All right, he said. Give me your hand. I'm going to have to show you.
When I had slipped into other minds, there had always been a queasy feeling of sinking involved in it, More often than not, I found myself dropped in the middle of a swamp of dimly lit memories and unrestrained feelings with no map, no flashlight, and no easy way of finding the way out. But there was nothing frightening about Clancy's mind. His memories were bright and crisp, full of blooming images and colors. It felt like he had taken my hand there, too, and was guiding me down a long hallway of windows into his past. We only stopped long enough for me to glance inside each of them. The office was plain, stuffed full of gunmetal gray filing cabinets, but little else. It could have been anywhere. The white paint was fresh enough that it bubbled on the wall. But I recognized the beginnings of a crescent-shaped machine in the back corner and the man staring me down from across the card table serving as his desk. He was plump and balding at his hairline and a permanent fixture in the infirmary. I watched his lips move in a soundless explanation, my eyes drifting down to the crisp stack of papers on the desk in front of him. My eyes kept drifting down to his hand resting against the table, weighing down a sheet of once-folded paper that was trying to curl back in on itself. There, at the top of it, the White House emblem. The words went into crystal focus, and I felt my eyes jump over them, drinking them in with disbelief. "Dear sirs, you may have my permission to run tests and experimental treatments on my son, Clancy James Beaumont Gray, provided these do not leave visible scars." The lights in the office grew brighter and brighter, bleaching out the memory. When they faded again, I was in a much different room in the infirmary, this one all blue tiles and beeping monitors. "No," I thought, trying to jerk free of the Velcro restraints that held me down against the metal table. I knew what this place was. The overhead lights were drawn down closer to my face by a gloved hand. At the corner of my vision, I saw the scientists and doctors in their white scrubs, setting up machines and computers around me. My jaw was clenched shut around the leather muzzle they had strapped to the back of my head, and hands kept my head still as wires and monitors were hooked up. I struggled again, twisting my neck far enough to catch sight of a table lined with scalpels and small drills. I saw my reflection in the nearby observation windows. Young, pale with terror, a mirror image of the portraits that would later hang across the camp. The harsh light from above grew and swelled, eating the scene. When it faded, the memory had changed again. My eyes fell first on the hand I was shaking, then slid up to the unfocused eyes of the same scientist I had seen before. The men hovering around us all had that murky quality to their expressions, blank smiles, blanker eyes. I squared my shoulders, a small thrill of victory working its way through my center as I moved through the main gate to the waiting black car. The man in the suit that welcomed me in with a perfunctory pat on the shoulder wasn't the president, but he appeared in nearly every memory that fired by next, ushering me onto stages in school auditoriums, outside domed state capitol buildings, in front of cameras at the centers of small towns. Each time I would be handed the same set of note cards to read, be faced with the same expressions of hope and deep grief from the crowd. Always, my lips began to form the same words. "My name is Clancy Gray, and I am here to tell you how the camp rehabilitation program saved my life." Another light, this time from a camera's flash. When the shock of it faded, I was looking up into a face that was an older, weathered version of my own. The photographer flipped the monitor around for us to see the portrait, and I was no longer seeing myself as a boy, but a young man, 15, maybe even 16. As the photographer set up his equipment again, this time across the room, I put a hand on the president's back, guiding him around the couches to the great dark wood desk. The rose bushes were scratching intently at the windows, but I directed his focus to the sheet of paper waiting there for him and compelled him to pick up the pen. When he finished signing, he turned to me with an unfocused gaze and a numb, unknowing smile. Weeks must have passed, months, maybe even years. I felt the exhaustion creep through me, wrapping itself like a heavy chain around my center. It was dark now. I couldn't place the time of night, though I saw that it was a hotel room and not a particularly good one. I was staring up at the ceiling, half buried under the covers, when a figure seemed to peel itself out from the shadows of the closet. It was fast, almost too much for me to keep up with. A man in a black mask, the metallic gleam of a gun. I threw my covers off of me and kicked my leg out, sending the attacker stumbling back. The shot went off from his gun with a combustion of light and little sound. The smell of it scorched my nostrils. I was flipped onto my back, one of the man's forearms braced against my neck, crushing the fragile rings of cartilage. My hands lashed out, hitting the rough carpet, the nightstand, and, finally, his face. Not even the terror pulsing through every inch of me kept me from crashing into his mind. Stop. I felt my lips form the word, but I couldn't hear myself. Stop. And the man did, with the blank look of someone whose skull had just been cracked open and exposed to freezing air. He sat back, his gun on the floor at his side. I was coughing and hacking, trying to bring air into my lungs, but I grabbed the gun and stuffed it into the waistband of my pajamas. I stopped long enough to grab my winter coat from where it had been thrown across the room's desk chair, and then I was outside, in the hallway, staring at the place where a man should have been posted outside my door to guard me. And I knew what was going on. I knew what would happen to me if someone were to find me alive in the morning. I was running down the hotel stairs, out through the kitchens, out back, past the dumpsters and through the parking lot, running, my chest on fire, hearing the sound of voices shouting after me, boots pounding on the pavement, running for the trees, the darkness. Ruby! Ruby! I came back to myself in Clancy's office, bit by bit, with a headache severe enough that I had to put my face between my legs to avoid throwing up all over myself. They tried to kill you, I said when I finally found my voice. Who?
Who do you think?
Clancy's voice was dry.
That man was one of the Secret Service agents who were supposed to be guarding me.
But that doesn't make any sense. I pressed the back of my hand to my forehead, squeezing my eyes shut against the dizziness. If they were carting you around and using you to explain the rehab program, then why?
Because he figured out that I hadn't been rehabbed at all, he said. My father, I mean. The only reason they let me out of Thurmond is because I made them think that I had been cured. But I got too ambitious. I tried to play my father by influencing him, and I got caught.
Clancy trailed off for a moment.
He was worried that the truth about the camps would get out, I'm sure, but he couldn't just take me out of the public eye, not when he'd been the one to thrust me into it. No, I think in his mind, it was easier to just get rid of me altogether before I could make trouble. I can only imagine what kind of spin he'd put on my murder to get back in the sympathetic graces of his fellow Americans.
I stared at him for a long while, speechless.
How did you survive that life? I wanted to ask. How are you you and not the monster they would have turned you into?
After I got out that night, I met Hayes and then Olivia and then others. We found this place and went to work, and all the while my father couldn't put a bounty out on me, not without exposing the truth about me and his rehab program. He had to make up some lie about me attending college to get the press off his back.
Clancy smiled then. So you see, I did win in the end.
He rose from his chair, reaching out a hand. I took it without being conscious of it, feeling some calm wash over me as he squeezed my fingers. My head was silent. I felt myself lean forward.
When I heard your story, I knew I had to meet you. I had to make sure that you knew the truth about what was going on, so you wouldn't be caught in the dark the way I was.
The truth? I looked up, startled. What do you mean? Clancy didn't release my hand. He only sat on the edge of his desk in front of me.
The woman who broke you out of Thurmond, the League agent? What did she tell you about the white noise they used that day?
That the camp controllers had embedded a frequency in it that only oranges, reds, and yellows could detect, I said. You must have known about that. They used the same method to broadcast to the location of the camp. That they were trying to pick out any of the dangerous ones that were still hiding out. Clancy released my hand and reached back to turn his laptop so it faced us. On the screen was a snapshot of my face on the morning they had brought us into camp, but the text beside it wasn't my history. Read the second paragraph aloud. I looked up at him, confused, but did as he asked. Camp Controller Harris discovered the discrepancy in the calm control at 05:23 the following morning, after noticing an underlying frequency that had been added without his consent. I paused, licking my dry lips. Upon further investigation of the recording devices in the mess hall, he came to the conclusion that the outbreak of violence there that resulted in the use of the calm control at approximately 11:42 was directly provoked by undercover operatives from the terrorist group, the Children's League. He believes these same operatives planted an identification frequency in the calm control. Psi subjects 3285 and 5312, who were taken from camp boundaries at approximately 0334 by a Children's League operative, are now believed to have been mistakenly identified as green upon their initial classification. Keep going, Clancy said when my voice trailed off. Subjects 3285 and 5312 are believed to be highly dangerous? Orders have been issued for their immediate recapture and reprocessing. Reprocessing? My eyes flew up again. But the way this is written, they didn't know. They didn't... Are you trying to tell me that they had no idea I was an orange until after I got out? Clancy nodded. It sounds that way. Then I wasn't in any danger after all. They wouldn't have killed me. Oh, you were definitely in danger, he said. They had all of the pieces, and it just took one curious mind to put it all together. But if you're asking whether or not you would have been caught if the League hadn't planted the frequency, then the answer to that is no, probably not. Then why did they do it? I demanded. It seems like a huge risk to take to only get a few kids. A few extremely valuable, rare kids. He corrected, kids that would have been killed otherwise. Seeing my expression, he added, not unkindly, You didn't really think they let any of the kids like us live, did you? Not oranges. Yellows, yes, because their threat can be contained. But not oranges. I passed a hand over my face. What about the reds, then? They were killed, too? No. Clancy said. His voice became quiet, hesitant. They had a much worse fate. I waited for him to continue, hands twisting in my lap. The President's classified program. Clancy crossed his arms over his chest, leaning back. Project Jamboree. Dear old Dad's been training himself a special army, using all of the reds they took from the camps. So you can see why, he cleared his throat, you can see why the League would be interested in finding any particularly dangerous kids for their own. I shook my head, dropping my face into my hands. Of all of the scenarios I had imagined, of all the things I thought had happened to those kids, this was too insane for me to have ever dreamed up. How could they force them into this? I asked, my voice sounding hollow to my own ears. Why did they agree? What other choice do they have? Clancy asked. They were made to think that if they didn't cooperate, something would happen to their families. They underwent a special conditioning program to make them think that they were needed and cared for, absolutely. Before my father and his advisors figured out I was influencing them, I was able to supervise enough of the program to ensure that they would be cared for, better than if they had been in camps, at least. He shook his head. Don't be afraid for them. They'll get out from under my father's control one day. And they're not dead, I thought. There's that.
Ruby. I looked up, feeling cold down to my guts. Let me show you what I know, he whispered, his other hand rising to brush the hair off my cheek. The clenched mass of nerves in my stomach eased at the touch, and I felt what few suspicions I had left about him unwinding. We were the same, in the ways that mattered. He wanted to help me, even though I had nothing to offer him in return. No one will be able to hurt you or change you if you can fight them off, he said softly. It wasn't depression that drove me forward. It wasn't even self-pity. It was a pure, distilled strand of hatred weaving its way through my core. I thought the slip kid would be able to help me reclaim my old life, but now I knew that wasn't enough. I needed him to help me protect my future. When I spoke, my words burned the air between us. Teach me. 23. Just because Clancy had all that power, it didn't mean he actually used it. It was strange to me that someone who could influence the thoughts of others had been born with a personality that naturally drew people to him. I witnessed it firsthand when he offered to give me a tour of the camp. Clancy waved at the few kids in black around the fire pit. His presence sent a buzz through the air. Smiles bloomed on every face we passed, and there wasn't a single person that didn't wave at us or call out some kind of greeting, even if it was just a quick, "Yo!" "Do you ever talk to any of them about what you've been through?" I asked. He glanced at me out of the corner of his eye, as if the question had startled him. I watched as he tucked his hands in the back pockets of his pants, his shoulders slumping with his thoughts. "They've put their trust in me," he said with a small, sad smile. "I don't want to worry them. They have to believe I can take care of them, otherwise our system wouldn't work." This system was something else. It's one thing to carve the size symbol into the side of buildings and string up banners over porches, but to actually internalize the message? My first true example of this came when the girl in charge of the camp's garden stomped up to us on the main trail and demanded that Clancy punish three kids who she believed had been stealing fruit under her nose. It took me 2 seconds of listening to Clancy talk the situation out to realize that the way of life at East River wasn't built on a foundation of hard and fast rules, but rested almost entirely on his good judgment and what everyone under him perceived to be fair. The accused were three green boys, only a few months out of cubbies. The girl in charge of the garden had left them sitting in the dark dirt like ducks in a row. Each wore black shirts, but their jeans were in different states of disarray. I stood off to the side as Clancy knelt in front of them, completely unbothered by the wet earth staining his own pressed pants. "Did you steal that fruit?" Clancy asked gently. "Please tell me the truth." The three boys exchanged looks. It fell on the larger one sitting in the middle to answer.
"Yes, we did. We're very sorry."
I raised my brows. "Thank you for being honest," Clancy said. "Can I ask you why?" The boys were silent for a few minutes. Finally, through some coaxing, Clancy got the truth again.
"Pete has been really sick and hasn't been able to come to meals. He didn't want anyone to know because he thought he'd get in trouble for not coming to cleaning duty this week, and he didn't want to let you down. We're sorry. We're so sorry."
"I understand," Clancy said, "but if Pete is really sick, you should have told me."
"You said at the last camp meeting that the med stuff was low. He didn't want to take any medicine in case someone else needed it."
"It sounds like he needs it, though. If he's too weak to come to meals," Clancy pointed out. "You know that when you take food from the garden, there's a chance that it could throw off the meals we have planned for everyone." The boys nodded, looking miserable. Clancy looked up at the kids gathered around us and asked, "What would you like them to do in return for taking the fruit?" The girl in charge opened her mouth, but an older boy stepped up and leaned the rake in his hands against the simple fence surrounding the garden.
"If they're willing to help weed for a few days, a couple of us will take turns sitting with Pete and making sure he gets meals and medicine."
Clancy nodded.
"That sounds fair. What does everyone else think?"
I thought the girl in charge was going to stamp her foot in anger when everyone else agreed on that punishment. She was deeply unhappy with the outcome, if the red in her cheeks was any indication.
"This isn't just a one-time problem, Clancy," she said, walking us out of the garden. "People think they can just come in here and take what they want, and it's not like we can lock it in the storeroom."
"I promise I'll put it on the agenda at our camp meeting next month," Clancy said with one of his smiles. "It'll be right at the top of new business." That seemed to satisfy her, at least for now. With one curious look flung in my direction, the Empress of Vegetables turned on her heel and marched back into her domain.
"Wow," I said. "She's a real gem."
He shrugged absentmindedly, fiddling with his right ear. "She has a valid point. If we start running low on food in the storeroom, we have to lean on the gardens, and if that's been picked over, we're in trouble. I think everyone here has come to understand how interconnected life is at East River. Hey, do you mind if I stop by and visit Pete?" I smiled. "Of course not." The little boy was buried under a mound of blankets. If the bare mattresses around it were any indication, the other boys had gladly donated theirs to his pile. When his flushed face finally emerged from the covers, I said hello and introduced myself. Clancy stayed to speak with him for a good 15 minutes, but I waited outside in the fresh air, watching the comings and goings of the camp. Kids waved and smiled at me, like I had been there for years, not a few days. I waved back, something tightening in my chest. I don't know when it had dawned on me, or if it had been a slow, creeping realization, but I had begun to understand that black, the color that I had trained myself to fear and hate, was the same thing that allowed these kids to feel a small measure of pride and solidarity.
"You'll never feel alone here," Clancy said, shutting the cabin door behind him.
We walked to the laundry building next, then made a stop by the wash houses to test the faucets and make sure the lights were still working. Every now and then, someone stopped Clancy to ask a question or air a complaint, but he was never anything other than patient and understanding. I watched him unravel a misunderstanding between cabin mates, take suggestions for dinner, and give his opinion on whether the security team needed more kids assigned to it. By the time we reached the cabin that served as the Cubby's classroom, I was dead on my feet. Clancy, however, was ready to give his weekly lesson on U.S. history. The room was small and crowded, but well lit and decorated with colorful posters and drawings. I spotted Zoo and her pink gloves even before I saw the teenage girl at the front of the room tracing a finger down the length of the Mississippi River on an old map of the United States. Hina sat next to Zoo, of course, frantically scribbling down notes. I suppose it shouldn't have surprised me, but the kids actually cheered when Clancy appeared in the doorway. The girl relinquished the front of the room to him immediately.
All right," Clancy began. "Who can tell me where we left off?"
"Pilgrims!"
a dozen voices chimed in.
"Pilgrims," he continued.
"What are those?"
"How about you, Jamie? Do you remember who the Pilgrims were?"
A girl about Zoo's age sat straight up.
"People in England were being mean to them because of their religion, so they sailed to America and landed at Plymouth Rock."
"Can anyone tell me what they did after they got there?"
About 10 hands shot in the air. He picked a little boy close to him. He might have been a green, but he could just as easily have been a yellow or a blue. My usual method of distinguishing kids from one another was failing me now that we were all mixed together, which, I suppose, was the point.
"They set up a colony?"
the boy answered.
"You got it. It was the second English colony, after the one set up in Jamestown in 1607. Not too far from where we are now, actually."
Clancy picked up the map the teacher had been using and pointed out both places.
"While they were on the Mayflower, they created the Mayflower Compact, which was an agreement that guaranteed everyone would cooperate and act in a way that would be beneficial to the colony. When they arrived, they faced a lot of hardships, but they all worked together and created a community where they were free from the English crown's rule and could practice their faith openly." He stopped pacing for a moment, casting his dark eyes out over his audience.
"Sound familiar?" Beside me, Zoo was all wide eyes. I was sitting close enough to see the freckles on her face, but more importantly, feel the happiness radiating off her. I felt my own heart lift. Hina leaned over to whisper something in her ear, and her smile only grew.
"Sounds like us!"
someone called from the back of the room. "You bet," Clancy said, and talked for the next hour and a half about how the pilgrims interacted with the native tribes, about Jamestown, about all the things my mother used to teach at her high school. And when he had used up all his time, he took a small bow and motioned for me to follow him outside, amidst all the groans and complaints from the cubbies. We were both still chuckling as we walked to the fire pit, where they were just starting to set up for dinner. I felt a number of eyes latch onto us immediately, but I didn't care. I actually felt a small thrill of pride.
"So?"
Clancy said as we stood beside the office's porch, listening to the bells calling everyone to dinner. "What do you think?" "I think I'm ready for my first lesson," I said.
"Oh, Miss Daly."
A smile curled at the edges of his lips.
"You already had your first lesson. You just didn't realize it."
2 weeks passed like a page tearing from an old book. I spent so many hours of so many days locked inside Clancy's room, pushing images into his mind, blocking him from trying to do the same, talking about the League, Thurmond, and White Noise, that we both fell out of sync with the camp's schedule. He had his daily meetings, but instead of asking me to leave, he had me wait on the other side of the White Curtain, where we were now conducting most of our practice sessions. There were times he had to go out and inspect the cabins or handle an argument, but I almost always stayed up in that musty old room. There were books and music and a TV at my disposal, which meant I never once had the opportunity to be bored. I still saw Chubbs at some of our meals, but Clancy often had food brought to us. Zoo was even harder to track down because when she wasn't in class, she was with Hina or one of the older yellows. The only time I really spent with the two of them was at night, before the camp's lights were shut off. Chubbs, more often than not, was a ghost, always working, looking for ways to catch Clancy's attention by stitching up the kid who'd split her lip or suggesting a more efficient way of harvesting the garden. The longest I sat with him was when he took out my stitches. Zoo, for her part, delighted in showing me what she had learned in school and the tricks the other yellows had taught her outside of it. After a few days, she stopped wearing her gloves. It only really hit me one night while she was brushing out my hair. I had pulled away to go switch off the lights, but she beat me to it. She snapped her fingers and the overhead light blinked out.
"That's amazing," I gushed.
But it would have been a terrible lie to say I didn't feel a pang of jealousy in how much progress she had made. I had only been able to block Clancy out of my mind once, and not before he had found out about what had happened to Sam.
"Interesting," had been his only comment.
While I saw Zoo and Chubbs every day, Liam was a completely different matter. The security team had him scheduled for the second watch, 5 p.m. to 5 a.m., all the way at the far west end of the lake. He was usually too tired to stumble back to the cabin after his shift, and spent most of his days sleeping in the tents they had set up near that entrance. I saw him once or twice, talking animatedly to a crowd at breakfast, or visiting with Zoo at Cubby's, but it was always from the window of Clancy's room. I missed him to the point of a real, physical ache, but I understood that he had responsibilities. When I had a thought to spare, it usually went to him, but I was so focused on my lessons that it was hard to let my mind drift to anything else for too long. Clancy laughed, drawing my attention back to him from the window, and I suddenly wasn't sure how I could let my thoughts wander. He was wearing a white polo shirt that emphasized the natural glow of his skin and pressed khaki pants casually rolled at the ankle. Whenever he was out with the others, he was properly buttoned up, his clothes clean and ironed within an inch of their lives. But not with me. Here, we didn't have to put on any show. Not for each other. When we first started these lessons, it had been from either side of his ridiculous desk. It felt like I was squaring off against a school principal, not being guided through a psi lesson by my freak guru. Next, we had tried the floor, but after a few hours of sitting, my back felt like it was ready to crumble. He had been the one to suggest sitting on his narrow bed. He had taken one end, and I had taken the other. Then we started inching closer, bridging the distance on his red quilt, nearer to each other with each lesson, until one day I snapped out of whatever haze Clancy's dark eyes had put me in and realized our knees were pressed up against one another. "Sorry," I mumbled when I turned back to him. "Can we go from the top?" He found everything about me amusing, apparently.
"Take it from the top. Are we rehearsing for a play? Should I get Mike in here to start building props?"
I'm not sure why I laughed at that. It wasn't even all that funny. Maybe trying to throw my brain at his for the last 20 minutes had made me loopy. The only thing I seemed sure of was how big and reassuring his hand felt as it took mine and squeezed.
"Try again," he said. "This time, try to imagine that those invisible hands you were telling me about are actually knives, cut through the haze."
Easier said than done. I nodded and closed my eyes, trying to fight back the flood of color in my cheeks. Every time he used my lame way of explaining how my brain seemed to work, I felt embarrassed, even a little bit ashamed. He had laughed the first time I made the comparison, waved his fingers in front of my face like he was casting a spell over me. He had tried a number of different methods to try to demonstrate how to do it. We'd gone down to the pantry so I could watch him slip into Lizzie's mind and, for no other purpose than to make me laugh, ask her to cluck like a chicken. Clancy had tried to show me how easy it was to affect the moods of multiple people at once, settling an argument between two kids without saying a single word. At one point, we'd sat on the stoop of the office and he'd read me the thoughts of everyone who passed by, including poor Hina, who was apparently harboring a desperate crush on Clancy. The truth was, he could do everything and anything. Block me out, push in an image, a feeling, a fear. Once I was sure, he had even passed on a dream to me. I didn't want to feel like I was disappointing him, not when he was giving me so much of his precious time. The thought made everything inside of me clench with fear. He told me to take it slow, that it had taken him years to master all of this. But it was impossible not to want to rush through the lessons, to get a grip on my abilities as soon as possible. It seemed to me that the best way to repay his kindness was to master myself to the point where I could stand beside him and feel pride, not shame, in what I could do. Until I could unlock his secrets, we were never going to be equals. He had called me his friend several times during our lessons and in front of other kids, and it surprised me how much I recoiled at the term. Clancy had hundreds of friends. I wanted to be more than that. I wanted him to trust me and confide in me. Sometimes I just wanted him to lean closer, to tuck my hair behind my ear. It was a repulsively girly thought, though, and I wasn't sure what dark corner of my mind it had come crawling out of. I think my head was playing tricks on me, because I knew what I really wanted was for Liam to do that. Do more than that. But every time I tried to slip into Clancy's mind, I was thrown back. Clancy had so much control over his powers that I didn't even have time to feel the usual disorienting rush of thoughts and memories. Every single time, it was like he had drawn a white curtain around his brain. No amount of tearing could bring it down. That didn't mean I didn't try, though. Clancy smiled, reaching over to brush my hair back over my shoulder. His hand lingered there, sliding over to cup the back of my neck. I knew he was staring at me, but I couldn't bring my eyes up to meet his, even as he leaned closer. "You can do this. I know you can." My teeth clenched until I felt my jaw pop. A muscle twitched in my right cheek. I tried drawing the hundreds and thousands of wandering fingers together, focusing them into something sharp and lethal enough to penetrate his wall. I squeezed his hand, increasing my grip until I'm sure he felt pain, and threw the invisible dagger toward him, diving in as fast and hard as I could. And still, the moment I brushed up against that white wall, it felt like he had reached over and slapped me across the face. He sighed and dropped his hand. "Sorry," I said, hating the silence that followed.
No, I'm the one that's sorry.
Clancy shook his head.
I'm a terrible teacher.
Trust me, you are not the problem in this equation.
Ruby, 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 he said. This isn't an equation.
You can't solve it in three easy steps, otherwise you wouldn't have accepted my help, right? I looked down as he began to rub his thumb over my upturned palm, a slow, lazy circle. It was strangely calming and almost hypnotizing to watch. That's true, I began. But you should know I haven't exactly been honest. That got his attention. The others, they were looking for you because they thought you were some magic man that could get them home. But I wanted to look for you because I was banking on the rumors that you were an orange and that you might be willing to teach me. Clancy's dark brows drew together, but he didn't let go of my hand. Instead, he rested his other palm on the sliver of space between our crossed legs.
But that was before I told you what the League was planning for you, he said. What did you want me to help you with?
No, let me guess. Something to do with what happened to your parents, right? How I erased myself, I confirmed. How to keep it from happening again. Clancy closed his eyes for a brief moment, and when he finally opened them, his eyes seemed darker than before, almost black. I leaned in closer, picking up on a strange mix of sadness, guilt, and something else that seemed to be seeping through his pores.
I wish I could help you with that, he said. But the truth is, I can't do what you can. I have no idea how to help you.
I have no idea how to help you. Of course. Of course he didn't. Martin was an orange, too, but he didn't have the same abilities I did. I wonder why I'd assumed the slip kid would.
If you tell me about it and explain how you think it works, then I might be able to figure something out.
It wasn't so much that I couldn't talk about it. It was that I didn't want to. Not right then. I knew myself well enough that I could predict the choked words and teary explanation that would follow. Every time I let myself think about what had happened, I always came out the other end exhausted and shaking, feeling every bit as scared and hopeless and horrific as I did when those moments had actually occurred. He watched me from under those dark lashes of his, a look of understanding quick to come, his thumb hovering over the pulse point in my wrist.
Ah, it's a Benjamin. I should have expected that, I'm sorry.
Seeing my look of confusion, he explained, Benjamin was my old tutor back... Well, back before everything went to hell. He passed away when I was very young, but I still can't talk about it. Still hurts. One side of his mouth curled up in a rueful smile.
Maybe you don't have to say anything at all, though. We could try something else.
Like what?
Like you blocking me this time, not the other way around. I bet it'll be easier for you.
Why do you say that?
Because you're not vicious enough to put up a good offense. Trust me, that's a compliment.
He waited for me to smile before continuing.
But you are guarded. You don't show your cards to anyone. There are times that you are impossible to read.
I don't mean to be, I interrupted. Clancy only waved me off.
It's not a bad thing, he said. In fact, it'll help you.
Well, it certainly hadn't helped me fend off Martin.
Can you sense when someone is trying to break into your head? He asked. There's a tingling sensation.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. What should I do when I feel it?
You have to push right back up against them, throw them off whatever track they might have been on. In my experience, the things you really want to protect, like memories or dreams, they have their own natural defenses. You just need to add another wall.
Every time I tried to get into your head, it was like a white curtain blocked me. Clancy nodded.
That's the way I do it. When I feel the sensation, I push back the image of that curtain and I don't let up, no matter what. So what I want you to do is bring to mind some kind of secret or memory,
something you wouldn't necessarily want me or anyone else to see, and I want you to drop your own curtain down to protect it. I must not have been doing a good job of hiding my hesitation, because he took both of my hands in his again, lacing our fingers. "Come on," he said. "What's the worst that could happen? I see some embarrassing moment. I think we're good enough friends now that you can trust me when I say I won't tell a soul about any falls or public puking. What about streaking and eating playground sand?" He pretended to consider it for a moment, grinning. "I suppose I could refrain from sharing that with the entire camp at dinner." "What a fair, just leader you are," I said. After a moment, I added, "Do you really consider me a friend? Or are you just saying that because you want to see me get my four front teeth knocked out when I tried to play soccer?" Clancy shook his head and laughed. His favorite stories always seemed to be the ones that involved me trying to pretend I was a boy, or the fast food binges my dad used to take me on when my mom was out of town at a teacher's conference. They were so completely foreign to his experience, I realized, that I must have seemed like an alien. "Of course I consider you my friend. Actually," he began, his voice low. When he glanced at me again, his dark eyes were burning with a kind of intensity that made me feel like my head was full of air, ready to float away. "I consider you a lot more than that."
"What do you mean?"
"You may have been looking for me, but let's just say that I was waiting for you. It's been a long time since I felt like someone understood what I was going through. Being an orange, you can't compare it to what the others are. They don't understand us or what we can do."
"It's only us," came a small voice in my head. "It's just the two of us."
I squeezed his hands.
"I know."
His attention seemed to wander, his eyes carrying over to the other side of the room, toward his computer and TV. I thought I detected a glimmer of sadness in his eyes, a real kind of pain, but just as quickly, it was gone, replaced by his usual confident expression. "You ready to try?" I nodded.
"I promise I've been trying. Please, please don't give up on me."
I was surprised when I felt his hands pull free from mine, stunned when I felt them glide up my bare arms and over my shoulders. I didn't stop him. This was the thing about Clancy, the thing I was quickly coming to terms with. With him, I didn't have to be afraid, not of what I could do intentionally or by mistake. I didn't have to throw up every defense I possessed to keep my brain's wandering hands still, because Clancy was more than capable of keeping me out of his head. But Liam, he was something precious, something I could break with a single misstep, someone I couldn't be with, not right then, not the way I was. Clancy leaned forward to begin his work. I leaned forward, too, right up against his chest, where it was warm and smelled of pine and old books and thousands of possibilities I had never known. I didn't block him on the first try. I didn't even block him on the fifth try. It took 3 days, and his witnessing almost every sour, cheek-reddening memory in my head for me to finally throw up some kind of defense. "Think deeper," he told me. "Think about something you wouldn't want anyone else to know. Those memories will provoke your strongest defenses." There wasn't anything left that he hadn't already seen. I swear the kid could have been a brain surgeon for how sharp and accurate his pokes and prods were. Every time I brought to mind a memory or thought and tried to put an invisible wall around it, my defenses crumbled, as flimsy as waxed paper. Still, he didn't get frustrated. "You can do this," Clancy kept repeating. "I know you can. You're capable of more than you'll admit to yourself." It was his strange badgering for some kind of juicy memory that finally produced my first actual result. "Does it have to be a memory?" I asked. He seemed to consider this. "Maybe you should try something else this time, something you imagine." It could have been my mind playing tricks, but his face suddenly appeared much closer to mine. "Something you want, or someone?" The way he said it made me think it was a question,
a serious one cloaked by a casual voice. I kept my face impassive.
Okay, I said. I think I'm ready.
Clancy didn't look so sure, but I was. This particular fantasy had been creeping up on my dreams for weeks, invading the slips of time when I wasn't holed up practicing my abilities. It came to me in the middle of our third night at East River, right at the hour that separated day from night. I startled awake in bed, confused as I listened to Chubb snore and Zoo toss and turn. Every inch of my skin had tingled as I tried to process what I had just seen. If any of it had actually happened, if any of it might actually happen. This was a dream I could never share, one I carried deep inside my heart, tucked so far down that I hadn't even realized it was there until it sprang out of me, fully formed. I must have dreamed we were in spring. The cherry blossom trees at the end of my parents' street in Salem were in full bloom. We drove past them in Black Betty, Liam and I sitting up in front together, listening to a Led Zeppelin song that might not have even been real. Outside of my parents' house were white balloons, tied off on either side of the white fence's gate, floating arrows that pointed us up to the open front door. Liam took my hand, wearing exactly what he had worn the day I had met him, and together we walked straight down the house's main hallway, through the pale yellow kitchen, until we found the door to the backyard and everyone outside waiting. Everyone. My parents, Grams, Zoo, Chubbs, Sam. All sitting around a blanket my parents had spread out over the grass, eating whatever it was my dad was grilling. Mom was running around, tying up more balloons, her hands still stained with dark dirt after planting all of the new pale flowers that flooded over what once had been a yard of plain grass. We said hello to everyone. I hugged Sam. I pointed out the birds up in the trees to Zoo and introduced Chubbs to my mother. And then Liam bent down and kissed me, and there were no words to describe that. Clancy's intrusion came like all the others had before, first with a tingle, then with a roar. I had been so lost in thinking about the dream that I hadn't even felt him take my hand to start that trial run. I liked Clancy a lot, more than I ever expected, but he didn't have a place in this dream. There was nothing there I wanted to share with him. I clenched his hand back hard and threw everything I had into sending my other set of hands out from inside me, like a shove. His curtain strategy hadn't worked for me, but this one, using offense as defense, this one was maybe a little too effective. Even before I opened my eyes, I felt Clancy jerk back, sucking in a hiss of what sounded like pain. "Oh my God," I said when I finally shook the haze from my mind. "I'm so sorry." But when Clancy looked up, he was smiling.
"Told you," he said. "Told you that you'd figure it out."
"Can we do it again?" I asked. "I want to make sure it wasn't a fluke."
Clancy rubbed at his forehead.
"Can we give it a rest for a little while? I feel like you just tackled my brain."
But Clancy didn't get a rest. Almost as soon as the words had left his mouth, we both heard a very different kind of warning. There was a shrill wail from the other side of the room, one I had never heard before, almost like a car alarm. He winced, tucking his head down to escape the noise, even as he jumped up from the bed. He made his way to his desk, flipping open his laptop lid. His fingers flew as he typed in his password, the blue-white screen of the laptop illuminating his pale face. I came to stand behind him just as he clicked open a new program.
"What's happening?" I asked. "Clance?"
He didn't look up.
"One of the camp's perimeter alarms was triggered. Don't worry, it might be nothing. We've had animals step a little too close to the wires before."
It took me a minute to realize what I was looking at. Four different color videos, one in each corner of the screen. Four different viewpoints of the camp boundaries. Clancy leaned forward, bracing his hands on either side of his laptop. He reached across me to get to the wireless black radio sitting on the other side of his desk. He never once took his eyes off the screen.
"Hayes, do you read me?"
There was a moment of silence before Hayes' gruff,
"Yeah, what's up?"
came crackling through the speaker. "The southeast perimeter alarm was triggered. I'm watching the feed now, but..."
I think what he was going to say was, I don't see anyone or anything, but his next words had me ducking under his arm to take a look at the screen myself.
Yeah, I see a man and a woman, both in camo. Unfriendlies, by the look of it.
And there they were. They looked well into middle age, but it was hard to be sure. Both were wearing what could only be described as hunting attire, head-to-toe camouflage. Even their faces appeared to have been painted brown.
Got it. I'll take care of it.
Thanks. Get them to back off, will you? Clancy said carefully, then turned the volume of the radio all the way down. Southeast perimeter. Good. Not Liam's area. I let out a grateful sigh. My eyes were still on the screen when Clancy shut the laptop lid. Let's get back to work. Sorry for the distraction. I could feel my surprise betray me. Don't you need to go out there? I asked. What's Hayes going to do to them? Clancy only waved me off. Again.
Don't worry about it, Ruby. Everything is under control.
One crack might not be enough to bring a fortress's defenses down, but it was enough to splinter into two cracks, and then three, and then four. After the initial breakthrough, it became a mission of mine to find different ways to slip into Clancy's mind. I never got to stay for very long before I was unceremoniously tossed out, of course, but every small victory spurred me on to achieve another, and then another. I could catch him when his thoughts were focused on something else, trick him into trying to protect one memory while I was really going after another. It surprised Clancy, but I thought it also, in a secret way, excited him. Enough, at least, to have me start practicing on others. It was like running downhill in a way. The momentum carried me through all sorts of experiments, big and small. I made a spectacular mess of dinner one night when I pulled each of the six kids working on it aside and planted six very different ideas about what they were supposed to be making for the meal, all at the same time. I had one girl so convinced her name was Theodore that she began to cry whenever anyone told her otherwise. It became so easy, in fact, to convince someone to do what I asked, or suggest that they had done something they really hadn't, that Clancy told me it was time to move on to trying to do the same without having to touch the unsuspecting test subject first. I was getting there. Slowly, and maybe not entirely surely, but there was something almost delicious about feeling the same powerful swell of abilities that had once terrorized me, corked, and controlled. Every aspect of them became sharper, easier. But on the Tuesday that followed, we were interrupted again. One of the older yellows, a girl named Kylie, came pounding on Clancy's door. She didn't wait to be let in. I actually fell off the bed with the force of her entrance.
What's this about you denying our request to leave?
Tangles of dark curls flew around her face. You let Adam leave, you let Sarah's group leave, you even let Greg and his guys go. And you and I both know they have the collective brain power of a fly. The floorboard squeaked as I took a step back toward the bed. Clancy had left the curtain open when he went to answer the door, so Kylie had a full view of me. She whirled back toward Clancy, who had put two pacifying hands on her shoulders.
Oh, my God! Are you in here fooling around? Did you even look at my proposal? I spent days on that.
I read it three times, Clancy said, motioning me forward with his hand. He looked at her with the same calming smile and patience he had shown me since our lessons began. But I'm happy to discuss why I had to decline now. Ruby, tomorrow? And just like that, I found myself outside in the morning sunshine. The spring weather was still sporadic, cold and dismal one day, perfectly warm the next. Spending 2 weeks holed up with Clancy had made keeping up with the season's bipolar tendencies even harder. I stripped my sweatshirt off and pulled my hair up in a messy bun. My first thought was to check in on Zoo, but I didn't want to interrupt her lessons. I tried to find Chubbs in the gardens, but the girl in charge told me, in her bossiest voice, that she hadn't seen him in a week, and she was going to rat him out to Clancy for the punishment he deserved. Punishment? I repeated, bristling, but she didn't elaborate. I found him in the next logical place. You know, I called as I stepped onto the dock, bread is actually bad for ducks. Chubbs didn't so much as look up. I sat down next to him, but but it only prompted him to stand up and stalk away, leaving his bag and book behind.
"Hey," I called. "What's your problem?"
No response.
"Chubbs."
"Charles." He whirled back around. "You want to know what my problem is? Where do I even start? How about that it's been almost a month and we're still here? How about the fact that you and Lee and Suzume are all off making friends and skipping around even though we're supposed to be working to learn a way to get home?"
"Where is this coming from?" I asked. Maybe he hadn't fit in as naturally as Liam and Zhu had, but I saw him talking to other kids as he worked. He seemed okay, maybe not happy, but then again, when was he ever? This place really isn't that bad.
"Ruby? It's horrible," he burst out. "Horrible. We're told when to eat, when to sleep, what to wear, and we're forced to work." "How is this any different from camp?"
I sucked in a sharp breath.
"You're the one that wanted to come here. I'm sorry it's not living up to your high and mighty expectations, but it works for us. If you'd just try, you could be happy here.
We're safe. Why are you in such a hurry to leave?"
"Just because your parents didn't want you, it doesn't mean that the rest of ours don't. Maybe you're not in a hurry to get back, but I am."
He might as well have shot me straight through the chest. I felt all of the blood leave my heart as one of his hands came up to clutch his dark hair.
"I've been working so hard. I've been trying, and God, you didn't even ask him, did you?"
"Ask him?" But I knew. As soon as the words left my mouth, I knew exactly what promise I had neglected to keep. The anger in me deflated.
"I'm so sorry. I've been so wrapped up in lessons that I forgot."
"Well, I didn't," he said, and left me standing alone in the sunlight. An hour later, I was under a stream of warm water, hands pressed to my face. The camp's washrooms, one for boys, one for girls, were about as glamorous as an outhouse. The floors were beveled concrete, the shower stalls wood planks and plastic curtains crawling with black mold. We used the rooms every night to brush our teeth and wash our faces, and, once or twice a week, to shower. But today, without floral shampoo and conditioner perfuming the air, I realized the cavernous room smelled like sawdust. I stayed in there until I heard the bells signal the end of lunch. I still hadn't formulated a plan for the rest of the day when I walked outside, and into the one person I hadn't realized I was desperate to see. Liam stumbled back a few steps at impact, his wet hair clinging to his cheeks, longer than I remembered.
"Oh my God," I said with a laugh, pressing a hand to my chest. "You scared the hell out of me."
"Sorry about that." He smiled, extending a hand toward me. "Hey, I don't think we've had the chance to meet. I'm Liam." 24. I don't know how long I stood there staring at his hand, bile rising in my throat as fast and steady as a scream.
"Oh my God, no," I thought, taking a step back. "No, no, 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 no."
"See, you look exactly like a friend of mine, Ruby, but I haven't seen her in ages, so I'm..." His voice trailed off. "Okay, was that joke really that bad?"
I turned around, pressing my face against my towel so he wouldn't see my tears.
"Ruby?"
He looped his own towel around my waist and drew me to his side. That was the Liam Stewart way of saying, "Hi, darling. Missed you something fierce."
"Oh, wow. Bad enough to make you cry?"
He smoothed his hands down over my hair.
"Okay, that's it."
He bent down and before I could stop him, lifted me over one shoulder. Liam didn't let me wiggle free until we were back at Cabin 18. He dropped me on the folded futon that Zhu and I had been sharing, making a quick stop at his bed for a blanket. "I'm not cold," I said when he wrapped it around my shoulders. "Then why are you shaking?" Liam sat down next to me. I turned so my face was resting in the crook of his neck, and I was breathing in his clean, woodsy smell.
"I'm just pissed at myself,"
I said when I found my voice. I told Chubbs I'd asked Clancy if he could use his laptop, but I got distracted and forgot. Liam's fingers were busy untangling my wet hair. I don't think he's upset at you. I think he's upset that I'm keeping us here. It's just reinforcing his fears about not getting home. How do I make it up to him? Well, for one thing, you could ask about the computer, he said, his other hand taking mine. Though I still don't really understand how you are in the position to ask to borrow it. I feel like I haven't seen you in ages. You haven't, I said. You're always on watch. He laughed. It's lonely sitting up in a tree without you. I want to hear about what you do all night, I said. Have you tried talking to anyone about freeing the camps yet? I brought it up with some of the guys on my watch, and Olivia. She's trying to get us in to see Clancy about it. I think it's going to be great. I really do. It could work. Clance said that the Western Gate is the one that used to give them the most trouble, I said, twisting to look up at him. You're being careful, right? Liam went very still beside me, so still that he seemed to forget to breathe. Clance, huh? He said in an unnaturally light voice. I guess you are in the position to be asking favors. What's that supposed to mean? Liam sighed. Nothing, sorry. I didn't mean for that to come out like that. It's great that you guys are friends. I tried to look up at him, but he was looking at the other end of the cabin, where a set of drawers with our things rested against the wall. So, he's been giving you lessons? Yeah, I said, wondering how much, if anything, I should hold back. He's been teaching me how to keep others from prying into my head. What about tricks to keep you from slipping into others' heads? Liam asked. Is he helping you with that, too? He's trying to, I said. He said that if I strengthened my control over my abilities, that would come naturally. Well, you can always practice that with me, he said, resting his forehead against mine. I felt the trickle start at the back of my mind, the warning before the flood. Clancy had told me that when I felt it coming on, I needed to break all physical contact and imagine a white curtain sweeping between me and whomever I was with. But I didn't want to do either. I felt his lips travel from my forehead, whispering something against my eyelids, my cheeks, my nose. His thumbs stroked the length of my jaw, but even they stilled as I pulled back and turned away from him. What are you so scared of? He whispered, his voice laced with hurt. Had this boy really once just been a stranger? Had I really once thought that I'd be able to live a life without him in it? I don't want to lose you. He made a noise of frustration, his eyes clear and bright as he spoke. Then why are you the one that keeps letting go? I never got the chance to answer. A moment later, Hina burst through the cabin door, Zoo in tow, and told us they were leaving.
Okay, slow down, Liam said.
Zoo was darting around the cabin, collecting her things, as Hina's mouth ran a mile a minute. I wasn't sure whom I was supposed to be paying attention to, my friend or the girl she had, apparently, elected to speak for her. Every time Hina opened her mouth, Liam and I reverted back to the same state of shock. Zoo. Leaving. Leaving. I caught her on her way to the drawers, steering her to the futon and forcing her to sit. She must not have picked up on our shock, because her face was bright and glowing. I studied it, the way her smile seemed to crackle with her own brand of electricity, and felt something inside of me shrink in defeat. Us and three others, Hina said breathlessly. I wondered if she had run all the way over from class.
Two blues and a yellow. Kylie finally got permission to leave the camp.
Liam twisted around to look at Zoo when he said, And go for a hike? Zoo made her, Are you serious? Face.
Help me out here.
Tell me what you want to say. Hina was finally silent, and for a moment, one crazy second really, I thought Zoo was actually going to open her mouth and have out with it. Liam's entire body tensed, as if he was expecting the same thing. But Zoo only slipped her notebook back out of her pink duffel bag and wrote in her neat, looping handwriting. When she flipped it over, she was looking him right in the eye. I want to go with them to California. I know I should have been happy for her.
I should have been celebrating the fact that she was finally able to come out and tell us exactly what she wanted. I just never imagined what she'd want would be a future without us.
I thought Clancy turned down Kylie's request to leave, I asked Hina.
He did, but she said she finally wore him down.
What's in California? Liam asked, leaning against a cabin wall.
My parents have a house there, Hina explained, and they're waiting for us. The West Coast government isn't going to turn us back over to the camps.
What about Zoo's parents? I asked. To her credit, Hina knew what I was trying to ask without my having to ask it.
My father has not been on speaking terms with my uncle for some time.
Zoo, that's a long trip, Liam began uncertainly. What if something happens? Who else is going? That Talon kid? She nodded, and all of a sudden her eyes were on me. I tried to give her an encouraging smile, but I was worried I might burst into tears instead. We all waited as she scribbled out another hasty note and showed it to Liam again.
You don't have to worry about me anymore. Isn't that good?
I like worrying about you.
Liam put a hand on her head. When would you be leaving? Hina, at least, had the decency to look guilty.
We actually have to leave right now. Kylie is worried. Clancy might change his mind. He wasn't all that happy.
That's a little fast, I choked out. Have you really thought about this? Zoo looked right at me when she nodded. The next note was for both of us. I want to be with my family. I just don't want you to be mad at me.
Mad? Liam shook his head.
Never, ever. You're my girl, Zoo.
We just want you to be safe. It would kill me if anything happened to you.
There was a knock at the door. Talon, an older yellow with his hair woven into intricate dreadlocks, appeared first, followed by a wide-eyed Chubbs. Liam stood.
Good, he said. I was hoping to talk to you.
Talon nodded.
I figured. Kylie and Lucy are here, too.
She stuck her head inside and waved.
Do you want to talk outside?
Liam's hand reached out and touched the small of my back.
Help her pack? Are you nuts? I heard Chubbs say. You barely know these people.
Excuse me, Hina protested, her hands on her hips. In case you've forgotten, she's my cousin.
I'll miss you too.
Zoo stopped piling her things into her pink suitcase and tore the sheet of paper out for Chubbs to keep. He sat so suddenly that he almost missed the futon. For several moments, he couldn't do anything other than stare at her. I knew the feeling.
Did Kylie say why you guys had to leave tonight? I asked, sitting beside Chubbs.
Zoo only shrugged.
I mean, are you guys just going to walk to California?
Chubbs said, his voice rising with each word.
Do you have some kind of plan?
Maybe you'll find a new Betty, I said.
But the moment I uttered her name, Zoo stopped packing and shook her head. The next note took some time for her to write.
No, there's only one Betty.
And apparently she wasn't enough for you, Chubbs said, with a shocking amount of hurt. I guess everything is replaceable. Even us.
Zoo took a deep breath, walking over to him with her pink bag at her side. He tried to look away, but she was standing right in front of him, wrapping her arms around his neck. All he could do was hug her back, his face hidden in the fabric of her jacket. The camp's bells began to ring, a frenzied sound that didn't cease until it had driven everyone outside. I let Zoo and Hina lead us, pushing a path through the gathered kids. This was the first time their black garb seemed remotely appropriate. Kylie handed a piece of paper to Lee, and he nodded at whatever she was telling him. Lucy was next to them, as tiny and quiet as ever, but she reached up and patted Liam on the shoulder in what I guess was supposed to be a reassuring way. All happy pretenses were gone. The only way to describe the look on his face was stricken.
"Borrow that pen?" he asked Talon.
The boy began to pat down his black cargo pants, searching the pockets until he came up with a blue-capped pen. With it in hand, Liam knelt down in front of Zoo and tore off half the sheet of paper Kylie had given him. I wished I could have seen what he had written there.
but it wasn't for my eyes. When he was finished, he folded the paper over several times and pressed it into her palm. The bell fell silent. Everyone's eyes shifted to the right, where Clancy appeared at the head of the path, haze towering beside him. His face, which I had grown used to seeing relaxed and proud, was pinched with what was either annoyance or anger. "Kylie has decided to go tribal and will be leaving immediately." A murmur of surprise rippled through the crowd. "She will only take these four with her," he shouted over the noise. "There will be no more requests to leave granted until our numbers are full. Is that understood?" Silence. "Is that understood?" Chubbs jumped beside me at the noises and shouts, confirming that, yes, it was. Clancy turned sharply on his heel, without another word, heading back in the direction of the office. As soon as he reached the white building, the kids around us seemed to exhale the collective breath they had been holding, turning to each other with confused whispers.
"That was weird. Why didn't he give them bags like he usually does? He's worried if our numbers get down too low, there won't be enough people here to protect the camp."
My eyes floated up toward the office until they fixed on Zoo waving me over. "No gloves," I thought, watching her hand fall back to her side. Hopefully, never again. "Do you really have to leave now?" I asked when I reached where she and Liam were standing. The clusters of kids swarmed Kylie and the others, wishing them good luck and offering up blankets and bags of food. Zoo put on a brave smile, wrapping her arms around my waist. "Please be safe," I told her. The next note was for me and me alone. "When all this is over, will you come find me? There's something I want to tell you, but I don't know how to say it yet." My eyes traced every inch of her face. It was so different from the girl I had met only a few weeks ago. If she had changed this much in so little time, how could I even be sure I'd recognize her years down the line, after the dust of all this hell finally settled? "Of course," I whispered, "and I'll miss you every day until then." Just before they stepped off the trail and into the untamed forest, Zoo turned and gave us one last wave. Beside her, Hina did the same. Then, they were gone. "She'll be okay," I said. "They'll take care of her. She should be with her family. Her real one. She should be with us." Liam shook his head, his breath catching in his throat. "Then, maybe we should follow her." Liam and I turned back. Chubbs was trailing behind us, his eyes hidden as the drooping sunlight caught his glasses. "You know we can't," Liam said. "Not yet."
"Why not?"
Chubbs advanced toward us, his voice losing all semblance of calm it held before. Feeling the curious eyes on us, I drew them both off the main path.
"Why not?" Chubbs repeated. "Clearly we aren't going to get the help we need to track down our parents or Jack's. It'd be better for us to just go now before anyone misses us. We could still catch up with her."
"And do what?" Liam asked. He ran a frustrated hand through his already mussed-up hair. "Wander around until we just so happen to stumble on them? Hope that we don't get our asses caught and thrown back into camp?"
"Chubbs, it's safe here. This is the place we're supposed to be. We can do so much good from here."
I saw, maybe even before Liam did, that this was the wrong thing to say. Warning alarms went off in my mind at the sight of Chubb's nostrils flaring and his lips twisting with anger. I knew that whatever was about to leave Chubb's mouth would not only be sharp, but cruel.
"I get it. I get it, Lee, okay?"
Chubb shook his head.
"You want to be the big hero again. You want everyone to adore you and believe in you and follow you."
Liam tensed.
"That's not," he began angrily. "Well, what about the kids who followed you before?"
He slapped around the pocket of his trousers before pulling out a familiar folded piece of paper. Chubb's grip on the letter nearly crushed it.
"What about Jack and Brian and Andy and all of them? They all followed you too, but it's easy to forget about them when they're not around, isn't it?"
"Chubbs," I said, stepping between them when Liam advanced, his right fist swinging up. I'd never seen him look so perfectly furious before. a wave of crimson washing up from Liam's throat to his face.
"Can't you just admit you're doing this to make yourself feel better, not to actually help anyone else?" Chubbs demanded.
"You think..." Liam almost couldn't get the words out.
"You think they're not in my head every goddamn second of every..."